Okay. Oh, yeah. That's promising. It doesn't like it. Wireless signal is too weak. Okay. Good morning, everybody. Might try this one more time. Yeah, glad to be with you here today. I'm a little ill today, and I think when I do that, I turn back into the professor rather than the preacher, so get ready for some lessons today. I'm not sure why I got onto this, but I thought it would be interesting to talk about what happens to us when we die. And I was going to talk about hell today and then heaven next week. But I usually when I do this, I have to give a kind of preamble to kind of orient you as to what in the world we're talking about. This will be challenging without the use of a chart. We'll see how we do. You know, I think I'm connected on the guest one. Okay. Please be patient, technical difficulties. You're right. Oh, you know what? I do have that one. Okay. Good solution. You know what? It did like that better.
What's that?
Hey. Nice one. Well, is there any more serious topic than death, really? What happens to us when we die? You might have heard about those 12 Thai soccer players who were in that cave and their coach. I'm not sure, how long were they there, Austin?
Over 2 weeks.
2 weeks. You know what, I mean, they knew the authorities were coming to help them and the world was watching. And still, I can't imagine what it was like in the darkness thinking about all of this and contemplating what would happen if I passed away. Is death the end? Does it end at that point? Do I kind of black out? Do I enter nothingness? What happens to me when I die? Am I still myself? You know, I think a lot of people imagine that church folks talk about this topic a lot. But we don't really. I mean, we kind of get people ready for that moment in time, for the big judgment day. But I don't know I've ever been pelted with a lot of sermons about death and hell and heaven before. And so we're going to look at that a little bit today. Psalm 49, verses 10 to 15 say, "Those who are wise must finally die, just like the foolish and the senseless, leaving all their wealth behind. The grave is their eternal home, where they will stay forever. They may name their estates after themselves, but their fame will not last. They will die, just like animals. This is the fate of fools, though they are remembered as being wise. Like sheep, they are led to the grave, where death will be their shepherd. In the morning, the godly will rule over them. Their bodies will rot in the grave, far from their grand estates. But as for me, God will redeem my life. He will snatch me from the power of the grave." And that is our hope, to be among those counted as the wise, is counted as the righteous in the eyes of God. Our present body is only a temporary structure, of course. This will not last for eternity. Indeed, they say there's something in our genes that makes us deteriorate with age. So death doesn't have any power over us. Since it doesn't take away something from us, but gives us something, we might leave this world in poverty and come before the Lord in riches. We might leave this place in pain and lowliness and come before the Lord in family and love. I read about this. A young girl was asked if she was afraid of walking through the cemetery. She said, "No, because my home is on the other side." In the same way, we don't have to fear death. Just a quick review of who we are might be in order. Let's see if I have any slides on that. No, I don't. Our nature, we have a soul as well as a body. 1 Corinthians 2:11 says, for whom among men knows the thoughts of a man except the man's spirit within him? In the same way, no one knows the thoughts of God except the Spirit of God. People often wonder, what is my soul? If I have a soul, what is that exactly? I remember watching a show called That's Incredible. I think that was the name of the show when I was a kid. And it had featured this doctor, crazy doctor. I don't know how this guy did this, but he would put people who were right before death on a scale, on a very sensitive, this is kind of creepy, but on a sensitive scale, and he claimed they lost weight at the moment of death, as if the soul had weight to it. I don't know if that's really true, but that was pretty weird, all right. It is true that we have two natures. These fit together without conflict, without interfering with one another. I don't feel my soul in any way. I don't feel my soul is located somewhere in my body. It is by definition the immaterial part of humanity. It is immaterial, thus it does not have weight as far as we know. We're certainly not, it's not something you can touch or so forth. Nowhere in the Bible do we get the impression that one could reach in and hit it if one got stabbed or something like that. Also, it has knowledge. We see by this passage, who knows the thoughts of man except a man's spirit within him? Sometimes the soul has been thought to be our conscience or our morality in one way or the other, but it doesn't seem to be distinguished in that way. It's just like your mind. My old psych prof used to say that the soul is the wind that blows upon the physical brain. I thought that was quite poetic, but who knows exactly what these souls are, and yet we are spoken of as having them, and this being part of us. Matthew 10:28, Jesus says, "And do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." That's the idea of his statement is that, hey, don't fear people who are persecuting you. All they can do is kill you. No big deal, right? Instead, fear him who is able to do something to your soul, that you would enter into the judgment of God after death. These souls outlast the body, and they are what is left of us after we die. Interestingly, without our body, we are described as being unclothed in the Bible, which is a common fear of mine. I don't know if I've ever told you this. When I'm dreaming, I often will end up in some kind of public situation, not usually preaching, but in some kind of public situation without my pants on or, you know, half clothed. And it's so common in my dreams that I'll turn to the guy next to me in my dream and say, "It's all right, I'm just dreaming." It's just, I know that I'm, because it happens so often, it's just my personality type. The thing that you fear most, you know. And so in the same way, after death, we are spoken of as being unclothed. I don't want you to think that the soul is who you are and this body is a false part. That is not the teachings of Christianity. The teaching is that our body and soul are who we are. And when we don't have the body, we're missing something. That's the impression we're given, is that we're actually missing something when we don't have our bodies. Even though we do, we are said to continue to exist. Excuse me. 2 Corinthians 5 speaks about this. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 1. A lot of you have your Bibles. I'm just going to go ahead and bring it up for you. For we know that if the earthly tent, which is our house, is torn down, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For indeed in this house we groan, longing to be clothed with our dwelling from heaven, inasmuch as we, having put it on, will not be found naked. For indeed while we are in this tent we groan, being burdened, because we do not want to be unclothed, but to be clothed, so that what is mortal will be swallowed up by life. Now he who prepared us for this very purpose is God, who gave us the Spirit as a pledge. This is really quite a common teaching in the New Testament where Paul talks about what's going to happen to us, which is that we're going to like be clothed again someday with another body. So that when we die, part of us is removed. And he says, you know, that's not natural. We long for that time when we will once again have a body, although the body that we will be given on that day, the resurrection day, will be different than the one that we have now. Thus, we do not cease to exist when our body dies. And in the same way, our body is not an evil part of us. Sometimes people have thought that my soul is the good part of me and my body is the evil part where all the temptations come from. And that's not true. Our soul is fallen as well. Our soul is a place that generates temptation as well. But there will come a day, he is saying, when we will once again receive a new body. And I'll give you a timeline. If you're starting to feel lost, I'm going to give you a timeline to help make this all make sense. And thus, now we come to the part where it's like, well, what's going to happen? And so we kind of have to take a look at the end times and figure out how this is all kind of going to work. This is what I wanted to show you in a bit of a chart. I'll see if I can do my little, yeah, there we go. A little chart. Here's a little thingy. I don't know if you can see that. There we go. Yeah. All right. What happens to me if I die right now has to be explained in terms of what eventually happens to everybody when they die and kind of what God's timeline for all of this is. So this is just a rough chart. Looking at the sort of the timeline of the end times, we would be back here. We're sort of in this age when we call it the church age. It's just a time before everything kicks off, as described in the Bible, before the end times kick off, if you wish. And, you know, just looking at this, you can see we have certain events that are going to happen. And there's different understandings of how this will all occur or what's going to occur. So I've just brought a simple chart to show you some basic things of what's really going to go on. Okay, first of all, what happens is a period of tribulation. You may have read about this in the book of Revelation. It's really a bunch of terrible things that happened to the world. It's described as lasting 7 years. Whether it literally goes 7 years or not, there's some speculation about that. Some people think the church, which is to say you and I, will be raptured before all those terrible things happen. There's quite a bit of debate about that. I don't think that's going to happen. I think we're probably going to go through this, but be protected by God. Nevertheless, a terrible time will occur, lasting a fairly short period of time, really. And then Jesus returns. All through the Bible, Christ predicts his return, so does the Apostle Paul. And this is a major thing that we're kind of waiting for. At that time, a number of things occur with that. Jesus sort of shows up and starts a government, if you wish, on the world that we'll call the millennium. And we'll just read that. I just want to read this to you and kind of show you how it's all going to go. So it's interesting. I don't know if you've read Revelation lately, but the book of Revelation is quite pictorial. It has a lot of metaphors and tricky parts to it. And then if you keep reading it around chapter 20, it suddenly clears up and it sounds like a history book. And so I wish all of Revelation was quite so easy to understand. But here in chapter 20, verse 1, this is just after Jesus returns, then this is what happens. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding the key of the abyss and the great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. There's our 1,000-year reference. And threw him into the abyss, which is a place spoken of earlier in Revelation, and shut it and sealed it over him so that he would not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time. Then I saw thrones and them that sat on them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of their testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received the mark on their forehead and on their hand. And they came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. So a resurrection occurs. Christ comes back, and that place that Paul spoke about us getting new bodies, that occurs at that time. The rest of the dead did not come to the life until the 1,000 years completed. This is the first resurrection. So at that time, those of us who are dead, who are had walked with God, will be resurrected at that time, will be given that new body, and reign with Christ for 1,000 years, live on the physical planet for 1,000 years. To sum up the next three verses, the devil comes back, is released, and stirs up what remains of the nations. At that time, there will be people who are still alive, who had gone through the end times, who are not believers, and they live and die. They have mortal bodies. And I hope this isn't sounding too weird today. I know this is sort of a weird kind of a lesson. So I hope you're still with me at the end of all of this. Those people are just normal people. The end times come, as described in Revelation. Jesus returns, resurrects a bunch of people, and then a bunch of probably more people just kind of made it through the end times. They were not in that great battle at the end of the world called Armageddon. They were elsewhere. I mean, not every army in the world comprises every single person in that country. So there's just people who are still alive. And they just continue on their lives alongside of those of us who've been resurrected. And that happens for 1,000 years. Now, there's a fair amount of debate about that because there's nowhere else in the Bible this is really spoken about. But it seems very clearly spoken about here in Revelation 20. I'll just tell you the Catholic position, for example, is that this is all a kind of metaphor for life today. And they have some interesting points and some points that one could challenge. I would say it just sounds like it's described quite frankly, and that this isn't a metaphor for something else. But certainly some opinions about what happens then. Anyhow, after that period of time, it says in verse 10, and the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are also, and they'll be tormented day and night forever and ever. And we'll probably talk more about that next week. Then I saw a great white throne and him who sat on it, from whose presence earth and heaven fled away, and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books according to their deeds. And the sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them. And they were judged, every one of them according to their deeds. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. So, to sum up. Oh, sorry, I should get one more thing. Verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth has passed away, and there is no longer any sea. So, going back to our chart. What really is going to happen is there's going to be a thousand-year reign of Christ. And again, some people feel that's metaphorical for today somehow. But all of us agree that after that time is the day, the sometimes referred to as the last day or the judgment day. It's not literally the last day. It's just really such an important time that it's spoken of as being the day or the last day. It is the day for us in which we're kind of evaluated by God. It says, the dead are all brought before the throne of God, and the book of life is opened, and these, what they call other books, are opened. And I think we're all given a kind of review of our lives, a kind of this is your life, if you remember that old movie, that old TV show, a kind of review of your life about what you've done and the deeds of your life are evaluated before God. And after that period of time, we are resurrected. Those of us who were right with God are resurrected and given a body and enter into this place that we'll just call eternal heaven. And those who are not in the book of life are also resurrected, given a new body, and they are thrown also into the lake of fire, this place described as the lake of fire. One thing right now that I just wanted to point out is because what happens to us before that time? If you were to die right now, you wouldn't be resurrected, and you would be kind of in between those places. That's to say, eternal heaven, okay, so the book of Revelation describes a new heaven and a new earth, which is to say the physical planet is purged with fire or entirely destroyed. So some of us think it's like the earth itself has inherited some element from the sins that have been committed on it and are kind of cleansed with fire. Others feel the new heavens and new earth literally means the planet's wiped out and a whole new earth is created. Onto that new earth, it seems to be kind of a paradise. For whatever reason, there aren't any seas. How do they regulate temperature without seas? I don't know. And a city is placed on it. This city is called the New Jerusalem. and I won't describe it today. But a physical city is there, and we're all given new bodies, and we go back there. This is the place where I enjoy telling this to freshman students, because I like telling them that heaven is not a place in the clouds where you get a harp. Not that I have anything against harps, right? You know, or a halo or something like that. Heaven is back here. You get a body again, and you show up here. Are you okay? You walk around, you say things, you're going to meet people you knew before. You're going to have a resurrected body. I feel like I've told you this before about what the resurrected body is like, because it'll be the best, I imagine, the best version of you. It won't die. I imagine it won't get sick. You will all look like the best version of yourself. And of course, I will look exactly as I am right now. But we're not at that time. Are you following this? We're not there. You don't have, if you were to die right now, you're not given a new body and put on the new earth, because we're busy using the earth for stuff like this. So what happens to us in that moment in time if we were to die right now? Do we just, I don't know, not exist for a while? We call that teaching soul sleep. Some people believe, very few theologians of our ilk believe this. But some people believe that we just kind of fall asleep until that great day. And yet, there's a couple of reasons why we have a problem with that. One is that Jesus said to the thief beside him, "Today you will see me in paradise." Well, I don't mean today, of course. I mean like thousands of years from now, but it'll seem like today. And Paul also says in Philippians, "I don't know what's best. I want to be with the Lord, but I also want to be with you. But I know if I die, I will be with the Lord." So it at least seems to him that he's going to be in the presence of God. But again, he can't be in eternal heaven because that hasn't been built yet of sorts. Because it's here. He can't come here. He has to go somewhere else. Thus, we call that place, just a theological term, we call it the intermediate state. If I can't go to eternal heaven, what happens to me? This is, I just want you to know I'm from Saskatchewan when I say this, but is the intermediate state Saskatchewan? Students get a big kick out of that. Funny one. There aren't a lot of passages that describe this, but when it's described, there we go. This is Luke chapter 16. There was just this parable of a guy named Lazarus. He's described as dying. And what happens to him when he dies? The poor man died and was carried away by the angels to Abraham's bosom, and the rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, he lifted up his eyes, being in torment, and saw Abraham far away and Lazarus in his bosom. Are all of these things possible? Was this just made possible in this one instance to illustrate something? Won't debate that with you. But it's like Jesus just pulled a couple of words out of the vocabulary of Greek. Really out of Greek mythology. There's this place, the bad guy goes to a place that he uses here and is translated literally Hades. Now, I don't know if you know your Greek mythology, but Hades isn't, we don't use that usually in Christianity. That's not the same as hell or lake of fire. That's just actually a place from Greek mythology, ruled over by, I think the guy's name actually was Hades. And he would kind of manage the dead of the world. And so Jesus kind of just uses this term and says, you know, the bad guy was in that place. But it doesn't sound quite like Hades in Greek mythology. It sounds quite terrible, to tell you the truth. And he cried out and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus so that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool off my tongue, for I am in agony in this flame. Positively, Lazarus dies, and it says that he is in Abraham's bosom, which is like Abraham giving you a big hug. It's not as though Abraham is literally everywhere giving everybody a hug. But, you know, for him, Abraham was the patriarch of the faith. And this man was there to protect him. It was a very positive place, referred to elsewhere here as paradise. Hades seems very much like hell. Paradise seems very much like heaven, a very pleasant place. What happens to us when we die is not that we go into a kind of sleep. We don't enter into a unconscious state. We are described as saying things and doing things. And there is a kind of, you can see there's a kind of instant judgment. You say, well, isn't the judgment day like farther on in the future? Well, yes, there is. I think all those, it says that Hades was emptied into the lake of fire. And so there's a kind of, all these people who are in these places are brought back and judged and given a kind of review. And those who are found in the book of life enter eternal heaven. And those who are not found written in the book of life are enter into the lake of fire. But until that time, there's this kind of in-between place. And to get there, an instant judgment takes place. You'll instantly be aware of your situation. There's not going to be a long waiting room with that weird elevator music or something like that. It's going to happen immediately. And so, I mean, with God, these things are not out of control. These things are taken care of, and we are brought to a certain place. This also makes me think, by the way, related to ghosts. We're getting into some weird stuff today. Are there ghosts? Are there disembodied spirits that float around? Well, anything's possible. God could let someone go out of one of these places, but it doesn't seem that way. We're certainly not given that impression. We're given the impression anyone who dies is immediately brought to one of these places and goes through a kind of immediate judgment. So with all that preamble, now I'll tell you what happens when we die. I know I've done that already to some degree. Should you pass away today, I want you to know there's not going to be a break in your consciousness. We're not going to sleep, as I said. I think the first thing you'll probably be aware of is the presence of God. God is all around us. It's just that we're not able to see him directly now. And I think those of us who have experienced the presence of God, say in prayer, or you know, times of life where he kind of makes himself known to us, experience his presence as a kind of fulfillment. I think we are all made to be in the presence of God, to tell you the truth. I think that we're missing that now. I think we sense what we're missing in life to some degree. But heaven is primarily the presence of God. Sometimes people would say, what is heaven going to be like? Is it going to be lots of golfing? And this isn't like a sermon on heaven as such, but the sense is like, well, will it be lots of green fields? Heaven, as described in the Bible, is the presence of God. It is fulfillment where now is emptiness. It is a sense of connection where now we have only occasionally a sense of connection. And it's not just a connection with God, by the way. It's a connection with one another. We know one another unlike we do now. Right now, I'm presenting a facade to you, in essence. You think you know me, and you don't really. And I don't really know you. I know some of you. In heaven, we will be known as we know, 1 Corinthians 13 says. And so we immediately enter into this place, which is not only a place, but a kind of sense, a kind of perception of God. I think probably the next thing you'll see is an angel. The Bible describes angels in many ways, doing many things. Let me just say to you, in first-year theology, the most common question about which class did you like the most and which class did you understand the least is often angelology. The studies of what angels do and stuff like this related to the end times usually confuses the students. But angels are described as escorting us to the next place. Why does God need to use an angel? I mean, that's so expensive. He should just do it himself. I totally agree with you. Being from Winnipeg, I wouldn't waste my money on that. If I could just snap and make everything happen, I would do it. But God apparently doesn't mind spending the money to hire one of these guys and get them to do stuff. The angel has probably known you all of your life. The activity of angels as having to do with us is somewhat dramatic. Watching, guarding, fighting battles on occasion with the evil angels. Thus, this being that we can't see escorts us somewhere. This might interest you. Everything having to do with angels, as far as all that stuff I described, them fighting battles that bring about change on the world, all that stuff is kind of no interest to you after you die. You think you'd be getting to do more stuff, helping out, or challenging or fighting against the fallen angels, and yet you don't. All that stuff ends, actually, when you die. Now, we do participate with angels in things like worship, because they're said to be before the throne of God. But their battles, their victories, their challenges, all of that is behind you. The greatest angel would be of no help to you at this point, and the greatest demon could be of no hindrance to you. You are finished with all that stuff, in essence. In fact, the Bible implies we may soon help them. Again, as far as your personality, you continue being you. I don't want you to think that you join a great collective of minds and just sense eternity doing nothing. You continue being you. You speak, you walk around. Eventually, as I said, you're given a body. The temporary state you are in creates a kind of temporary afterlife, and you are instantly transported to either paradise or Hades. Again, those are weird terms, but they're very much like eternal heaven and eternal hell, yet neither of them is permanent. Thus, again, no believer has entered heaven. No sinner has entered hell. Final hell. They're not there yet. However, again, for you, I don't know that that really matters. God has a great plan for the world, and he carries it out, kind of even though things aren't completely finished yet. Paradise is very much like heaven, and Hades is very much like hell. And thus, after that, as I said, for those of us who are in the Lord, whose names are found to be in the book of life, there is a time where we are in this other paradise place until certain events happen in the end times, in which case we will be resurrected quite quickly and granted a new body, which will be our eternal state. Again, we do not teach the body as evil. We say that without the body, we are in an unnatural place. We are not meant to be floaty beings. Even the descriptions of the intermediate state have us saying things and doing things just as though we have a body. Finally, let me give a little bit of a side note as a kind of conclusion. Pardon me. We all want to know what happens to our loved ones once they die. I think some people have unresolved stuff when a friend or relative dies and they want to ask a question. They would like to ask that person how they are. They'd like to ask them what happened to them. They want to know that they're okay. And there are various means of trying that. I think, again, some people are innocent enough in thinking that they are merely trying to reach out to their loved ones through these means. This is not viewed positively in the Bible. This has existed for thousands of years, whether you might use tarot cards or Ouija boards or simply just trying to find someone who claims to communicate with the dead. This is viewed very negatively. Just a sample passage in Deuteronomy 18. When you should enter into the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not learn to imitate the detestable things of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or daughter pass through the fire, one who uses divination, one who practices witchcraft, one who interprets omens or a sorcerer, one who casts a spell or a medium or a spiritist or one who calls up the dead. For whoever who does these things is detestable to the Lord, and because of these detestable things, the Lord your God will drive them out before you. This is what we sometimes call the occult. It's not an organized religion. It's just a kind of a way of trying to find out the future or communicate with the dead. And this is something that is forbidden to us and that is best left alone. Most conclusions to sermons end on a positive note. So I want to end on more of a positive note. There is an ancient Greek by the name of Aristides in 125 AD, who is writing to one of his friends about this new religion, Christianity, and he was trying to explain the reason for its extraordinary success. Here's a sentence from one of his letters. If any righteous man among the Christians passes from this world, they rejoice and offer thanks to God, and they escort his body with songs and thanksgiving, as if we were setting out from one place to another nearby. God does not forget us. He has a plan for us about how we're to live and how we are to behave in this world. And he also has a reward for us as being given to us through his son. And this is not merely money or even a really nice house or a nice place to live, but it is his presence. It is his comfort. And it's his will for us that we seek him and even in this world connect with him today. Why don't we close in prayer? Father, we thank you that you are eternal and you understand all things. And Lord, we pray that we could find comfort, that we are not forgotten when we die. We thank you, God, that you look after us and care for us. And we thank you that you have such wonderful plans for us and that you wish us not to be, kind of making our own way after death, but that it is a pathway to your presence. We praise you for these things in Jesus' name. I guess the team is not coming back up. It's going to help us. Okay. Sorry.
First Corinthians 2:9 says, "No eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love him." And I am very thankful for that today. And thank you for sharing with us today, Jay. Had to leave early, so.